Welcome to this continuation of the Planetary Tantra Talks with myself, Touchstone Tom, and of course, my special guest, John Lamb Lash. I do need to mention this before we actually dive into the interview, that the night that we made the recording for this interview, we were experiencing some very bad Skype connections. And at times, actually most of the interview, it felt as if John was standing behind a waterfall, and I was only able to catch bits and pieces of what he was actually saying. But I guess that goes as a testament to how close our relationship has become, for I could almost telepathically know what he was saying for much of the interview, and supply the appropriate comments and questions. However, towards the very end of the talk, I basically was completely cut off. So please bear that in mind when you're listening, if you hear some things that don't really add up in your perspective. So as usual, kick back, get centered, and relax, because here we go. Welcome to the second edition of our Planetary Tantra Talks. This is 2 days after, or 3 days after, the new moon. It is March the 8th here in Japan in the evening, actually at night. And we are going to cover a lot of new stuff tonight. Where to start? I would like to start out with one short little announcement. I have put up a narration of the fall of the Wisdom Goddess. One has music embedded in it, and one does not. You can download both of them, or just one of them, whatever you would like to try your ear out with. And I would like to call out to any listeners out there who have a beautiful female narrative voice who would like to offer their talents to call me up, and I can record your voice doing a narration. We're working also on getting some big names here that are very interested in John's work. And that's the announcement I would like to make. John, is there anything you'd like to say as we start out tonight?
Well, I want to thank you for starting this process and kicking it off with a narration that you've done. It's crystal clear. It has a beautiful tone. You know, when the future archives of this planet are written, let it be known that you were the first one to put this narration out in a vocal, in a complete vocal form. It's a great, great step, and it opens the door to what comes next. Of course we want to have a narration of the Sophia vision story in a female voice. I mean, obviously. So I'm very happy that we're able to put out this invitation, and we'll see what comes.
Very good. Well, John, let's jump into things. We've got a lot to cover as usual. To start out, we did have kind of a little bit of an outline set up for ourselves to work with, but there is a quote I would like to read that I don't want to surprise you, but there's a quote here that I really need to get your comment on, because it's something that just resonates so vibrantly with myself, and I'd like to read this for you.
Sure.
It's something you wrote in the Tantric Conversion 2.
Sure.
And I'm going to go ahead and read that and get your comment. It says, liberation is not escapism, not a flight from the sensory world. It is a clear and steady centering in this world of sentient life and sensory impressions. Total recognition of this world as all there is nirvana. That floors me. I would love to hear a little bit more comment on that.
Well, sure. Perhaps I could say two things. First of all, my syntax, which is kind of a Dakini syntax, resonates very closely to Dzogchen teachings. Liberation is a realization that this world and what this world is all there is. is that's kind of a paraphrase of some of a message or teaching that you encounter often in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition of Dzogchen. I was very influenced years ago by a Canadian scholar named Herbert V. Gunther, G-U-E-N-T-H-E-R. He was a great exponent of Tibetan Buddhism and various teachings. He wrote The Life and Teachings of Naropa. He wrote Yoganada, The Tantric View of Life, and really tremendous, tremendously important books in the interpretation and dissemination of Tibetan Tantra. And one of the points that Gunther makes eminently clear is that nirvana and the perception of the infinite world order is no different than what you see now. It is just what you see now liberated from any conceptual elaboration. So this is a fantastic non-attainment teaching. I've been deeply guided by this through my entire life. And I carry this non-attainment teaching, this same non-attainment teaching, into Planetary Tantra. So you will find this same non-attainment teaching in Planetary Tantra. The second point that I would make is a Gaian orientation of liberation. Generally, the Buddhist teaching of liberation has been that we are freed from something, you know. In the original message of the Buddha of the 5th century BC, which, by the way, was the exact midpoint of Kali Yuga, about 550 BC, was the exact midpoint between 3102 BC and 2216 AD, when Kali Yuga ends. At that midpoint moment, the historical Buddha elaborated his message. And one part of his message was that his outer message, or his message to the world at large, was everything is suffering, dukkha. And the cause of suffering is attachment, trishna. We don't stay in samsara and in bondage to illusion because we suffer. We stay in it because we are attached to our suffering. This is a very, very profound message of the historical Buddha. And so there is a misleading inference that you can draw from that message. And that inference is, well, liberation, freedom, freedom from suffering, freedom from this attachment to suffering, is all in the same syntax. It's freedom from something. The fantastic breakthrough of Gayan Tantra is that it is not freedom from anything. It is freedom with. Freedom with. And this is the fantastic dynamic that is offered by this unique moment in time. When we realize where we stand as a species in Gaia's divine experiment, when we awaken with her in the lucid dream, we are liberated into a relationship. The liberation is not from this world, not from materiality, not from our illusions. It's not a liberation from anything. It's a liberation with her, in her power of animation. And so it's a fantastic extension. I wonder if you can see that. It builds and founds itself on the Dzogchen teaching of non-attainment, but at the same time is a fantastic extension of this teaching into a real experience of participation with the goddess and with the wisdom mother. And I find that so beautiful and so exciting.
Yeah, it's not a liberation or an escape from anything. It's an embrace of the embrace of the dream stuff of Sophia.
That's right. That's right. Because her dreaming is our higher reality. Her dreaming is our transcendence.
And that dreaming, is she going more rapidly into a lucid dream right as we speak? Is this kind of what we are experiencing right now?
She's waking up in a lucid dream. She's been waking up for about 250 years. And for her, that's a blink of an eye, by the way. You know, for us, it seems a long time. For her, it's like 10 seconds. And
you've put that date around, yeah, like the middle of the
1700s. Yeah, about 1760, 1776. Interestingly, around the time of the American Revolution and the French Revolutions, if you want to put it in a historical framework.
Mm-hmm. What are the indicators of that's when that next step of awakening into a lucid dream, what are the indicators of that happening?
You cannot find the indicators of that by any external process.
Okay.
You can only do it by entering the second attention and receiving what comes in the second attention. As it were, you enter the second attention and then you see the writing on the wall. And this is what you see.
So if you go into the second attention, this was something that you will just, you will know it.
That's right.
There's a knowing there.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And until it's seen, it's not seen.
That's right. It's not a rational construct.
Okay.
It's an actual beholding of the internal processes of her own psyche as you see them in the second attention. This is how intimate you can be with her.
So it's tying into your first point. It's a direct perception.
That's right.
Not conceptualized.
No, not at all.
And it's very, that ties in with Zazen as well.
It does. I mean, inevitably, people are going to ask, well, John, how did you figure that out? I didn't. Mm-hmm. I didn't figure anything out. You know?
Yeah, it's a beautiful, beautiful sentence, or actually two sentences that just really blew me over. I keep coming back to that. It really resonates with me.
Let me give
it. That's good to get some. Go ahead.
Yeah, let me just offer an analogy because I know that it can be difficult to grasp mm-hmm. these things, which are, in a certain respect, routine to a sorcerer
mm-hmm.
who practices heightened states of attention. Now, let me see if I can offer an analogy. A geologist will go out to some place in Canada or in Africa, to some remote uninhabited place where there are formations, for instance, banded iron formations, which exist in certain part of Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And these banded iron formations, which are found in certain mountain ranges in Africa and only there, contain a record of the reversals of the magnetic field of the Earth over many thousands and hundreds of thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
So the opportunity to go out and look at these banded iron formations, I can't tell you the name of the mountain range where they are because I don't know. It's not in my mind at the moment. But the opportunity to go out and examine them for a geologist is very one of the greatest thrills of that calling. So when the geologist goes out and stands there and looks at the side of this mountain and sees these banded deposits of earth, you know what that looks like?
Mm-hmm.
Everyone has seen that at somewhere in the geological foundation. Or think of the Grand Canyon and think of these bands or layers where the earth has been laid in. Yeah.
The striations.
Striations.
Layers.
Right. Yeah. The geologist is standing there in front of this cliff, in front of this mountain face, scanning with his eyes these striations and these banded iron formations. And from that, he reads the long-term history of the reversals of the magnetic field of the Earth, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you were asked the geologist who's doing that, well, gee, how did you figure out these long-term things? And he said, I didn't figure out anything. I just stood there and looked at these banded formations, you see?
Yeah, it's not conjecture.
That's right. It's not conjecture. It's not construction. So this is what I do. I go and look into her memory banks, and this is what I saw.
Can I ask you one more question about that?
Sure.
When did you first peer into that that band and realize that Sophia was awakening into a lucid dream in around the middle of the 1700s?
In the summer of 2008.
Okay, good, good. Yeah, okay, good. That's because that's what we want to work into. That's wonderful. Let's go right into that then. I wanted to just kind of roll around with you on any issue, but since the 2008 download experience comes up in this, and this is something that we had promised we'd talk about at the beginning of tonight's interview, so it's perfect.
Sure.
I want to ask you right about that. Please go into as much detail as you want about what happened in 2008. Is that in October? Is that correct?
It was in July. July and August.
July, okay.
July, August, basically from July, from the 24th of June, July, August, September, and into October of 2008. So basically it was like a 5-month period.
Mm-hmm. So what triggered that? What brought on the download? And then please go ahead and explain what actually that download experience itself was.
Okay. In the spring of 2008, April and May, I was involved with a woman, and the relationship went on the rocks. It crashed and burned.
Mm-hmm.
And I was pretty upset about that. I'm not going to go into the gory details, but I have written about this story. This is the Emma story, of course. I've written about this here and there on the website. And if you go to MetaHistory and you put the name Emma in the search function, you'll find the places where I have written about this story. Why is my personal romantic sexual trauma of any interest to anyone? Well, I didn't think it was of any interest to anyone but me at the time it happened.
Mm-hmm.
But I was proved to be very wrong about that. At the same time that happened, and I was going through the anguish of losing this woman and having this relationship end, and the way it ended was pretty hard for me to take. At the same time, I was continuing my usual mystical adventures, you know? I was writing for MetaHistory.org, which at that time was still supported by a non-profit organization in the United States. At that time, 2008, MetaHistory.org had been online for about 7 years. As you know, Thomas, there's a tremendous amount of content on the site. I'd written about all kinds of things. I'd written about the Grail. I'd written about the Archons and alien intrusion and everything. But something was building up in my mind, in my imagination. I was going up to Infinity Ridge. I was practicing telestic shamanism. What's that? It basically means that when you enter into an altered state using sacred plants or psychoactive plants, you don't just do it for the thrill of the experience. You set it up with a question or purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Telestic means having a purpose or aim. So in telestic shamanism, you go into these trance states and these altered states with a specific aim, and you take the aim into the state. You formulate the aim before you do the ritual. You take the aim into the altered state and you pursue the aim. This is what the Telestai Gnostic teachers of the mysteries did. So I was practicing this up on the ridge. And just exactly at the same time that I went through this romantic sexual breakdown, I was feeling tremendously compelled to start reporting to people, as it were, about my experiences with Gaia and my communications and conversations with Gaia, with Gaia Sophia on Infinity Ridge. Do you understand? I had been drawing from these experiences for a long time. I had been having these experiences since 2002, for 5 or 6 years. But suddenly I felt, or not suddenly, over the evolution of those years, I began to feel, well, this is time now to speak directly from what I am learning and receiving in my conversations with Gaia, to speak directly of these matters. And at that time, in the spring of 2008, a certain theme or question came up. It presented itself in the course of my metahistory work and through the dialogue and exchange I had with some of the people who were around me at that time, not physically here, but in my internet connections. These people were asking me, well, John, what can you say about the dire plight of humanity? Or what does Gaia say about it? Will you go and ask her? What the hell are we going to do, you know? Scientists are talking about a sixth extinction here. The human species is going to become extinct? You know, what's happening? What's going on? Could you go in these directed conversations that you have with her? Could you ask her and then come back and report, you know? So this.
And are you communicating with these people who are asking you the questions and then you're conveying the answers to them? Is this in a verbal exchange?
No, this was on the internet.
Through writings on metahistory? Or?
No, it was through writings on metahistory and through people writing into me on the internet.
Through mail exchange?
Yeah, through email.
Things like that.
Yeah,
okay.
Because no one actually was here but me. I'm the only one here, you know, doing this. So it built up. You know, it built up.
Can you tell us what the question was that you had formulated?
Yeah, the question was, and you have to formulate questions in pristine syntax. One thing that I'd point out is that you don't go to Gaia with some vague or generalized question. You have to go with a very precise, exact question. So my question.
That would make sense.
Yeah, right. Yeah, the syntax has to be very exact, otherwise it doesn't engage her attention.
Mm-hmm.
So the question that I asked, let me see if I can paraphrase it as close as to what it was at that time. How do those who would engage themselves with your purposes find their way through the coming extinction? That was a question I asked her.
Right.
Okay. Is that clear enough?
Yes, it is.
So, here is the Nahual going up to Infinity Ridge with that question. But at the same time, I'm just this guy, John Lash, and I have a big emotional problem with the end of this affair that lasted 13 months.
Sure, sure. So you got two different levels of energy going on at the same time.
Yeah. So the day that I went up to the ridge, which was St. John's, the Festival of St. John, June 24th, 2008, I had been in this emotional trauma over Emma for about 2 months, and I was honestly, I've said this before, but let me say it again, in words, vocally, I was completely out of my mind, completely nuts, you know? And I couldn't stop obsessing about her, obsessed about her 24 hours a day. And as I went up to the ridge to do my practice, I was a little concerned because you can't communicate with Gaia unless you have, to a certain extent, not entirely, but to a certain extent, you enter into silent knowing. And you silence the inner talk of your mind. in order to have a conversation with her. And I went up to the ridge with a certain feeling of doubt, feeling kind of insecure and questioning, well, am I going to be able to pull off this conversation with Gaia? I can't get this obsession about Emma out of my head, you know?
Yeah.
But I thought, well, nevertheless, I'm going to try it anyway, okay? So I'm up there on the ridge. It's absolutely splendid. Midsummer day, 3 days after the summer solstice in 2008, standing by the Devi tree where my guardian lives. If you want to see a picture of that tree, you can see it on metahistory.org.
Right, a photographic tour of Infinity Ridge.
That's right, yeah. Standing by the Devi tree. The cordings I've done are all around in these trees, these chaotic, yantric designs of blue, red, green, yellow, gold cord hanging in the limbs of these trees, sort of like spider webs. This is Infinity Ridge. And I'm standing up there and put myself into the posture of communication, which is done with a posture of standing. And you can also use certain mudras or hand gestures to lock yourself into the posture of communication. And so, okay, I do the usual stuff that I have learned to do and start to get Gaia coming in. I recognize her voice. She speaks to me in a certain way. I don't hear this voice, by the way, externally.
It's a sub-vocal voice.
Right, it's sub-vocal. I don't hear actually some voice, like as if it were coming from a radio, you know. It's sub-vocal. It's a voice in the silence, but it's very distinct. And I always know it exactly when I hear it. So I start the conversation, and I do get to make a few brief exchanges with her. But I'm troubled. I'm troubled because I can't get this woman off my mind. I thought, well, this is not a good practice, you know. This is screwing up my practice. So at a certain point, oh, boy, this was a moment, let me tell you. I was looking out toward the mountains, as I usually do when I speak to Gaia. And the Devi tree is off to my left, to my right, a little bit behind me.
Mm-hmm.
And I shook my head, and I thought, this isn't going to work, because I can't give my full attention to the goddess. And yet, I really need to have this conversation with her, really need to ask this question. I want to get an answer. I want to take this answer back and put it on metahistory.org, which I did, actually. She gave me the epitaph for the human species. Have you ever read that?
Yes, I have. It's incredible.
Yeah, perished for the failure to observe beauty. She said, go write that on their grave, the grave of the species.
Hmm.
Yeah. So I got that much.
Wow.
Yeah, right. So then I turn around. I'm sort of thinking, what am I going to do? I really want to go deeper into this because she started to tell me some fantastic things about anaerobic systems and how she's preparing to shut down certain systems. It was really fantastic. Huh. I mean, it's fantastic to converse with her. But I couldn't hang on to it. I couldn't keep my attention on her. So I turned around. I spun around towards the Devi tree. And I sort of cried out almost aloud. I said, damn. You know, damn it. What am I going to do? I really want to have this conversation with Vivi. And so,
but you're obsessed. A country boy can be obsessed with a woman, huh?
Indeed.
You can't get her. You can't shake her off, right?
I cannot shake this woman out of my soul. When I turned to the Devi tree,
very well.
You got it right.
Yeah.
All good men are like that. And when I turn to the Devi tree, I describe this at some in some piece I wrote. She struck. Kali struck. Now, Kali, when she strikes, is like being hit by a freight train. It ain't subtle. Mm-hmm. She hits you right between the eyes. And she hits you with what I call a serpent strike. If you imagine a cobra, a big one, big cobra, 40 feet long. And you imagine the power of a cobra. You know what a cobra looks like when it strikes?
Yes, indeed.
You see a king cobra from India. It stands on its tail.
Uh-huh.
Its tail is coiled, like an electrical coil. And then you have the long, long body of the cobra up to the hooded head. And then it darts that head forward. This is how Kali strikes. And she struck me right between the eyes. And I was totally paralyzed. And then she said, John, you ain't going nowhere. And you ain't having no conversations with Gaia or anybody else until you work through this woman. And I thought, what the fuck? This is really strange. I was really baffled that she said that.
So she's demanding you to do it right there.
She's demanding me to start right there. She said, you're not going anywhere. She says, you're not doing any of your practice until you work through this. And I was baffled, and I'll tell you why. Because generally speaking, the practice of telestic shamanism that I do, which I believe follows the model of the Gnostic seers, is not a personal affair. It really is transpersonal. It really doesn't have anything to do with your personal life. It's not about healing or therapy or asking personal questions or solving things for you. It's way, way, way beyond that, you know?
Sure.
And so it wasn't customary in the practices that I'd been doing for these years to bring up any personal material at all. I had been up on Infinity Ridge many times and spent hours up there in shamanic practice and never for a moment got involved in any personal issues. I was always investigating questions or exploring things or dealing with the technicalities of shamanism or docking new relationships or whatever, but nothing personal. And here suddenly my guardian, Kali, is telling me that I'm not going to get anywhere until I work through this personal situation. Well, needless to say, she had my complete attention. I stood there, and then she proceeded to say to me, and this is almost word for word what she said. I've never said this to anybody, but I'll tell you right now. She said,
please.
The experience you went through with this woman for 13 months of your life is much, much bigger than you or her.
Huh.
It was a tantric initiation that I led you to, I being Kali.
Kali, yeah.
And she said, and I know that you made every fucking mistake in the book with this woman. Mm. I know you did. And she said, and that's the way it was intended. Because by the mistakes that you made with her as a tantrika, I will show you how to produce the coming planetary tantra.
Oh.
That's what she said to me, I swear to you. And I practically dropped on my knees when she said that. And she said, every single mistake, Everything that you envisioned with her that you couldn't do, every way that you mishandled her in every respect, erotically, morally, physically, ethically, is going to produce a wisdom teaching. Every mistake you made is going to produce a wisdom teaching. Can you imagine being told something like that? It's very humbling, let me tell you, my friend. And so, you know, I can be slow in certain ways because I'm just a country boy from Maine, but I can also be fast. And at that moment, I was fast. And I totally got what she said. I thought, wow. I don't know how I'm going to do this, but now I know, now I realize that what my guardian says is true, that in whatever way I turn this around, this is a tantric expression, turn around. A tantrika turns things around. A tantrika can turn anything around, anything you throw at them.
Yeah.
Pleasure, pain, anguish, despair, joy, grief, confusion, loss, abandonment, denial, shame, guilt, anything, a tantrika turns around. And I knew that I was going to turn around my experience with Emma. And in doing so, came Planetary Tantra. It came out of the madness, an obsession of that love. It was born out of human, out of the mud of human emotion, the lotus born from the mud. And it could not be born in any other way, because this is how Gaia brings forth from us the treasures, the highest treasures that she wishes us to enjoy.
And as long as you are aimed and you're totally grounded in that sense, grounded in your aim, whatever she throws at you, you can roll with it, like you say, huh? You can transform it, take it, mold it, do whatever you need to do, because you know where you need to go.
As long as you are aimed, and as long as you have that support. It's impossible to do this if you don't have the support of Vivi herself and these Dakini powers. It is absolutely too much. I almost died.
I almost died
from this experience with Emma. I was out of my mind, really. I was an emotional mess. I would be sobbing in the supermarket buying a can of beans. I mean, I would talk to anybody who came down the road. I mean, I was a total basket case. And the only way that you can turn that around is when you have the support and the guidance of these divine feminine spiritual powers. And I'm here to tell you that you have it. You have it.
Mm-hmm.
All you have to do is recognize that you have it and claim it, and it's yours. And so I was very fortunate because my long history in my life allowed me to know that the goddess has always been with me and Kali has been in me for so long, and they got me through this. So that's how Planetary Tantra came into the world.
Now, you haven't actually at this point had the actual download yet, correct? This isn't the download itself, is it?
Yeah, I had the download totally. Complete.
Oh, so you're saying the strike of Kali, that in that instant was the download?
No, the download came.
Okay,
June 24th, 2008.
June 24th, right.
Then on July 21st, just a month later, I went up on the ridge. That's another story. I won't go into that. And I got the second How shall I say what happened then? That's when I received the Kalika initiation of tongue on knife. And this initiation is about the transmutation of your addiction, of your primary addiction. And it is the highest Dakini initiation that I know of in Kali Yuga. And I received that initiation on July 21st. And then on August 8th, just a few weeks later, I got the whole complete download of the Terma of Gaia Awakening. And after that, it was only a matter it's like a zip file, what do you call it? What do you call it when you open a zip file?
Exactly. You unstuff it, huh?
Yeah, that's right. And I've been unstuffing it ever since, you know.
Well, tell me, I want to hear the exact instant of that. What is the feeling of that?
Of what?
Is there a physical sensation that goes along with the actual downloading that happened to you on August the 8th?
Yeah.
Okay, can you please go into that a bit?
Sure. It's like an electrical shock. And you feel bliss and excitement. And you also feel something that I can only describe as lucidity.
A clarity.
Yeah, it's a lucidity that is staggering. Staggering. It is like crystal lucidity. Your mind is crystal. You have crystal mind. And in the moment of crystal mind, you see in the facets of a crystal, of the crystal of your mind, it has facets like a diamond that has been cut.
Yeah.
And in these facets is cognitive awareness. So it's a lucidity of enlightenment with knowing.
You can kind of rotate that crystal and see different sides of this.
You see everything at once. You see everything at once. And you know, this experience I'm talking about is not unusual. If artists have it very often, you know. For instance,
yes,
Balzac wrote The Human Comedy. You know, the French writer, Honoré de Balzac, wrote The Human Comedy.
That's right.
Which is like 20 volumes long or something. It's this massive serial novel and has like 242 characters in it. You know, it's massive.
Yeah.
But Balzac claims that he saw it all in 1 second.
Richard Feynman talks about that, the famous mathematician, that he was walking across the street in Paris, I believe it was, and he got hit with a download of information.
That's
right.
And
he knew he had gotten it. He ran back to his hotel room, and it took him, I think it was like 2 weeks or 3 weeks, to write down this mathematical formula that he got in one split second.
Exactly true. There are many examples, Thomas. You know, Mozart, I understand, in his biography, if he ever wrote one, or things that were written about him, recount Mozart's statement that he had this kind of experience, that his pieces of music came to him in their entirety. One of the examples that I like to quote is the Russian composer Alexander Scriabin, S-C-R-I-A-B-I-N. Scriabin was a mystic and a theosophist and a Gnostic in the Russian symbolist movement previous to the First World War, and a fantastic composer of very avant-garde music, one of the first composers of 12-tone music, and music that was just at the time that he wrote this music and played it, it was like from another world. People couldn't figure out where in the fuck this was coming from. It's very amazing, the 10 piano sonatas of Scriabin. And Scriabin wrote in his diaries that he just got this in its entirety. He would get a whole symphony in its entirety in 5 seconds.
On multiple occasions?
Yeah, on multiple occasions. That's right.
Wow. Yeah, and Rilke was the same way with the Dueno elegies.
That's right. And we have Rilke's own words because he wrote letters to the woman at whose castle he was staying, you know. He was staying
right.
at the castle of a princess in Italy. And he
yeah.
describes how he went out. He was sitting at his desk inside the room of the castle. No one else was there. He just had a rented floor. He had a floor that they gave him. And he was sitting at his desk. He was kind of irritated that day. It was in the afternoon, and he had some bills and some personal papers to sort through. And he opened up this letter, and it kind of irritated him because it had to do with some practical matter. And Rilke was not very keen on, you know, practical things. Didn't like
yeah.
to be bothered. And so he stood up. He felt restless. And he went over, and he opened the French doors, and he stepped out onto the balcony, and bam. That was it. Got the whole 10 Dueno elegies in one download.
And then from there, it's just processing that out, the you know, the actual physical conveyance of it. So that's what happened in your case as well then on August 8th.
August
8th. So what proceeds from there? How did this affect you energetically? How did it affect you in your daily movements from that point on?
Well, I was completely out of my mind with bliss for about 2 months. I was walking around like a Dionysian madman. I mean, I was essentially, I was manic, beyond manic. You know, it's manic. If you want to put a clinical term to it, it is manic. And people who see you in that state, like some of the people around me at that time, tend to have an ambivalent reaction. On the one hand, they find it very attractive because they're looking at a human being who is actually literally in a state of divine madness and divine ecstasy.
Yeah.
But at the same time, they're frightened of it.
Sure.
It's frightening. And you get burned. You get burned by it, too, if you don't watch out, because it's very high, high voltage.
Sure, of course.
So I was in that state, and I started immediately. I got the Shakti cluster in 5 seconds, the whole Shakti cluster. And then I just proceeded to transcribe it, which is the job of a Tertön. The Tertön receives these treasures, these wisdom treasures, instantaneously. And the discipline of the Tertön, through his or her learning and mental practice and scholarship, and mastery of language and syntax, particularly, then proceeds to transcribe as faithfully as possible the wisdom teaching or terma that has been received, and that's what I did. And it culminated on October 10th, 2008, when I got the secret Dakini name of Gaia, and I wrote the Gaian Tantra vow. And by then I had...
That's the date that you would subscribe to the starting of the Gaian Terma.
That's right. And then 108 days after that, because we do things in 108-day rituals. 108 days after that was January 26, 2009, and that was when I put it on the Terma of Gaia Awakening online.
Wow. I think it's just by chance that's about the time I hadn't looked at your site for a few months, and I'd clicked in right about, I think it was almost on that exact date.
Is that so?
It's like, yeah, and it's like, what is going on here? This is amazing. And I remember actually sitting down and starting to record audio files for my own benefit at that time. I did that for a few weeks or even a few months, just recording what you were writing at that time. It's amazing that timing came out that way.
Really? Very, very good moment to show up. Perfect moment to show up on the scene.
So the guy in Terma, you say, doesn't have a past. It's different in that sense that it has a future date where it's going to end in 2216, but it doesn't have a past, so it's continually new.
That's right. It's a wonderful distinction to make. The tradition of Tibetan Buddhism, especially the Nyingma cult, the Nyingma school, or the old school as it's called, is a shamanic tradition of diviners. And from the Nyingma school come the greatest lineage of tertons or treasure finders, such as Jingmi Lingpa, J.L. And Jingmi Lingpa, if you read about his life, he delivered the Terma of the Longchen Ningtig and these other very powerful Tibetan Termas, the most famous Tibetan Termas. But there's a norm or paradigm for the traditional Tibetan Terma. And it goes like this. According to the standard teachings, the founding master of Tibetan Buddhism, Padmasambhava, and his consort, Yeshe Sojal, implanted these wisdom teachings in the earth and in the clouds and in the mind, subliminal mind. And that is the source of the Nyingma Termas. In other words, they were preconceived by the founder of Vajrayana. They were preconceived, and then they were planted so that they would be rediscovered at a certain moment in the future by a certain or by whoever was destined through karma or whatever to rediscover them.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the norm, okay? This is the norm of Tibetan Termas. That is to say that they are wisdom treasures deposited at some moment in the past so that they can be retrieved at some moment in the future.
They're pre-programmed in a sense.
They're pre-programmed in a sense.
Yeah.
Terma of Gaia Awakening is utterly, utterly different from that. It was never pre-programmed at any moment in the past. Never.
Well, that really is an incredible distinction. I mean, that it's a whole new approach, a whole new paradigm. It's renewing itself. It doesn't even need to renew itself because it just is new constantly. It doesn't have to take an effort to renew itself.
It is constantly new. It is, to use a popular term, and I hope this term reaches people. I hope this term enables people to grasp the momentous significance of this opportunity. Is an open source spirituality. Now, it's a term from the internet. If you have an open source program, it means that you can go into the source code in which that program is written. It's of access to users. For instance, Microsoft Word, which most people use to write documents, is not an open source program because you can use the program, you can use the functions of it, the editing functions and all the hundreds of functions that are offered in Microsoft Word, but you can't access the code in which it's written. It's not an open source program.
Mm-hmm.
Neither is Google or any of these other things, whereas these other things like Linux or whatever it's called, Linux, there are other computer languages that are open source. Well, this is a good analogy. The Terma of Gaia Awakening is an open source program that taps in to the imaginative genius of the human species. This Terma is not from the past, it's actually from the future. And it is not a Terma that can be attributed to one single person. It is a group generated serial Terma with a duration of 208 years. And I'm only the inceptor of the Terma. I'm simply someone who puts a key in a door and turns that key. That's all. Everything that comes through that door is now accessible to the human species. And this is the beauty and the uniqueness and the unparalleled opportunity of the Terma of Gaia Awakening.
Well, you have unleashed some very powerful energies. I'm just now into the second cycle. And compared with what it was last month when I was feeling the surges that we're going through with the Matangi shift, which were incredible, almost vibrantly angry types of energies, but focused in their own way. The ones that we're going through now with this new moon and a few days after that, it's in some ways even a more powerful energy, but it's of a different flavor. It's of a different taste. So I couldn't really comment any more than that because I'm still not developed with the language yet.
Sure.
But you have released some incredible energies with this.
Well, the Shakti cluster is real. This is not a fiction
yeah.
of the imagination of John
yeah.
Lash. The Shakti cluster is as real as a cloud. It's as real as a virus. It's as real as nitrogen. In fact, it has a lot to do with nitrogen. It's as real as any other phenomenon of nature, but it is an intrapsychic interface with nature. An intrapsychic interface with nature. That's the Shakti cluster. And when you come into the presence of this cluster, it produces fantastic turbulence in your life. And this is real. And people are more and more telling me that they are feeling this. And they feel it vividly and immediately. And that is how it presents itself, I can assure you.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, you don't even have to feel it vividly. I mean, you can't help but feel it vividly. I mean, it's the most obvious thing in your life. It's just overpoweringly throbbing energy that pushes you right to the edge constantly.
That's right. It keeps you right to the edge. It keeps you pushing the envelope of your own reality all the time. That's right.
Now, would you like to talk any more about the download, or is there anything we could need to pick up and put out on the table here? Or would you like to go on to our next topic?
Let's go on to the next topic.
Okay.
I said just about all that I can say at the moment on that. I think I'd like to know how people respond to what I've said and if I've presented it adequately and clearly. You know, please let me know.
Absolutely, yeah. We're taking this with a very long-term attitude, so we can come back to these things as often as we need to give more explanation or more light on to be shined on these things. Let's go ahead and jump into another topic. In our last talk, you talked a lot about Melchizedek, and you had mentioned to me that you would like to make a little bit of a correction on some remarks that you had made, and I believe it had something to do with the divine experiment and Sophia's view on what's happening. Can you kind of tie those points together?
Yeah, certainly. They are closely related points. The correction I wanted to make is this. I referred to something in the Bible, and I think it's in Samuel. I wanted to say that I said that, at a certain point in the history of the Jewish people, they adopted mm-hmm. theocracy. That is to say,
right.
The elders of the tribe went to Samuel. This is in the Old Testament. And they asked Samuel, yeah, this is all in 1 Samuel, by the way.
Okay.
They said to Samuel, well, we need a king like these theocratic states, Babylon and all these places. We need one too. And I made a couple of errors in explaining how that happened because I haven't looked into the material for a long time and I didn't consult the Bible. So let me correct those errors. The first king who was appointed was Saul. And I mentioned that Saul had an encounter with the witch of Endor. It's not Endor, it's Endor, E-N-D-O-R. So Saul was the first man among the Jewish tribes of that time who was chosen to be the king. And the priests of Zadok, who represent this sinister and shadowy background figure, Melchizedek, did not actually show up at that point.
Hmm.
succeeding Saul came David. There was a lot of war and competition between David and Saul. In fact, David almost murdered Saul. Saul finally ended up killing himself after he went to consult with the witch of Endor, because she very cleverly manipulated his guilt and drove him to the despair of his own suicide. These are the stories in the Bible, and I'm making these up. So David became the second king. But the priests of Zadok did not show up at that point either. It was when the third king was chosen, Solomon, that the priests of Zadok showed up. And so you will read about Saul and David in the book of Samuel. And that will lead up to the historical moment, which is about 950 B.C., somewhere between 900 and 950 B.C., when Solomon was appointed king of the Jews. And at that time, these priests of Zadok, who represent Melchizedek, popped out of the background, and they anointed the king, the Jewish king, Solomon. And that's when the whole messianic concept took root, because a Messiah is simply the Greek form of a Hebrew word, which means the anointed one. So the anointed one was the king, but more significantly, who anointed the king? Because the anointing power is more powerful than the one who is anointed, obviously. Because the king only has authority if it's conferred upon him from some other source. And that source was Melchizedek. And so the anointing priests were the priests of Zadok. And that's the, more accurately, that's the, those are the details of that particular story. Now, I want to suggest to people that there's a lot of problems in the world today. As you know, as we all know, there are a lot of things going wrong. There's a lot of terror and fear seem to be coming to us from all directions.
Indeed.
That the fear of terrorism, the fear of eugenics program, chemtrails, poisoning of food, phony epidemics and hoaxes that are a pretext for inoculating people with mercury and other lethal substances, fluoride in the water, dumbing down of the human mind through entertainment and the media, the complete corruption of the media. We have all of these problems and all of these things that are working against humanity. And any sane human being who's concerned about the future of the human race, not to mention their own life, is going to stand back and look at all of these threatening developments and be a bit daunted and intimidated, naturally. And one of the difficult things is to focus. How can you focus when you have these apparently horrible developments happening on all sides? I'd like to suggest a way for you to focus. Go to the internet and go to Google and put in Google Melchizedek, M-E-L-C-H-I-Z-E-D-E-K, Chartres Cathedral. And do it in Google Images. And that will bring up an image from the carved stonework on the walls of Chartres Cathedral. And there will be...
Of Chartres.
And there will be Melchizedek.
Okay.
Melchizedek is this very tall, austere-looking figure, biblical figure, with a sort of a cap rather than a crown. The long beard, standing there very stately, a long Gothic figure. You know how Gothic images are elongated, Gothic sculptures.
Yeah.
And holding, with his right hand, I believe, holding at the center of his breast a cup.
Actually, it's his left hand. Yeah.
Right. Oh, his left hand. Okay. Holding a cup, which is reputed to be by some idiots who study these things, the Holy Grail.
Sure. That's what people would assume, I would guess, yeah.
Right. Now, I'm here to tell you that that is not the Holy Grail. that Melchizedek is holding.
Huh.
And I'm here to tell you that if you want to know and concentrate and focus your imagination on what is threatening humanity, then look at this figure, because this figure is the icon of the opposition. This figure is the icon of the opposition. Print this out and put it on your refrigerator. And every day when you get up and you reach in there for some milk or some breakfast cereal, look at this figure of Melchizedek. That is the opposition. That is what is working against humanity. That figure is an icon for everything that is wrong on this planet. And that is a very good way to have that figure in front of you. It's a very good way to focus your mind on the opposition. Is that clear?
That is very clear. I'm hoping you'll continue on with that a little bit, because I'm really digging that. What does this mean for us? I mean, how can we work with that as we've recognized and spotted this person or this entity as the representative or the icon of the whole, what we'd actually call, you'd have to call your enemy in that sense.
The archontic power.
How do we focus on that? How do we use that that energy? How do we use our energy of wrath and anger at this representative? How do we channel that into that?
Melchizedek.
Against that.
Right. Melchizedek is the agent of the archontic powers, the archons. And according to the Gnostic teachings of the mysteries, the archons are a problem for humanity. But at the same time, they're a great opportunity. If we can see that the archons present an opportunity, there's a chance for a tremendous breakthrough for humanity and a tremendous correction of our problems. It's exactly like Castaneda said, you know, and I've drawn these parallels between Castaneda and Gnostic teachings. It's exactly like Castaneda said about the flyers and the inorganic beings who envy us and who trick and deceive us.
Right.
This is what the archons are. And you don't have to worry about how many kinds of beings and ETs and aliens might be tricking us or deceiving us. You don't have to start thinking about, you know, are they coming from Beta Reticulum, or are they coming from, you know, Sirius, or are they coming from Brooklyn? You know, forget it. That's all a distraction.
Yeah, from the rings of Saturn.
Yeah, are they coming from the rings of Saturn? Blah, blah, blah. Forget all that. It's a huge distraction. Concentrate on the assertion which comes from the best of sources in the ancient of ancient wisdom, that there is one key predatory species, the archons. One of the fantastic advantages that we have from the Gnostic teaching of the archons is the simplification that it affords. What I've come to understand, in essence, is this, that if we can detect the archons, detect their presence and their influence in our midst, face that, resolve that, and overcome it, then we can face any other kind of alien or deviant phenomenon that we might encounter. So we don't have to get involved in elaborate scenarios or channelings from the Pleiades or these 4, 5, 6 volume books that are describing Star Wars 10 million years ago and, you know, predatory beings who are coming from at us from all directions. Forget it. We'll never, ever sort that out by giving your mind and imagination to such scenarios. But if you concentrate on the opposition, the main figure of the opposition is Melchizedek, who is, by the way, the guardian angel of the state of Israel. And the archons are the predatory mind parasites that we have to face. and understand. And once we do, we can handle anything else that the cosmos might throw at us. Who knows? It might not be anything else. I, for one, will be happy to assert for my mystical adventures here and there around the cosmos that I don't find any evil in the cosmos anywhere. There's no evil in the universe. There isn't. But there is in the human reality and in our solar system, there is a predatory, deceptive species. It's deception, not evil. And human beings fall into evil because they are subject to this deception. This is the proposition. This is how it works. So, let's go back to this idea of the opposition. I'm using this term. Melchizedek represents the opposition. And this can lead us, this concept of the opposition can lead us into the next part of our conversation here, Thomas, which I'm looking at here in the notes that we exchanged. The logical thing to ask when you're presented with this proposition about the opposition is this. Well, opposition to what? What are the archons the opposition to? You know? What is Melchizedek the opposition to? Yeah.
Exactly. What is he in opposition to? It isn't a real opposition anyway.
It is a real opposition. It's not illusory. It is real to the extent that we make it real in our own minds. Give you an example.
Uh-huh.
If a bunch of people are sitting in a theater, this is a very classic example. If they're sitting in a movie theater watching a movie and somebody yells fire, what happens?
You run out in a panic.
Everybody runs out in a panic. Some people get killed and trampled in the process, and people get hurt, don't they?
Uh-huh.
And that happens even if there wasn't a fire.
There's no real threat. There's just a perceived threat that causes people to act like insane lunatics.
Threat fulfills itself in real behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's real and not real at the same time.
That's right. But let's return to this question. The archons with their icon of Melchizedek represent the opposition. But the opposition to what? Well, I'll tell you, my friends, it's eminently simple. The opposition to the divine experiment. We are involved. We are figures and actors and agents and subjects in a divine experiment in the imagination of the earth. In Sophia's imagination. We're not just the biological products, you know, of the earth. Of course, the earth is our mother, if you want to use that metaphor. The earth is the mother of all the biological species that live in the biosphere, right?
Sure.
Mother of snails and snakes and scorpions and whales, just as much as she is of us. But you see, she's not just a biological mother. She is a pleromic divine being. And we are the product of her imagination just as much as we are the product of her biological processes. And in Gaia Sophia's imagination, there's a divine experiment taking place. A divine experiment unfolding, and the opposition is to this experiment. So I'd like to try to describe how this situation looks from Gaia's own viewpoint. It's not exactly that I would speak for her in this instance, but more or less speak about how she views the situation. I'd like to try to do that.
Okay.
Okay. And to do that, I'm going to follow the...
You are cutting out so bad on my end, John, that I'm not really able to follow you. So
okay.
Just piece things together as well as you can there.
Okay. Well, you're going to have it intact. It's being recorded. So I don't know how we're going to work this out, but it's being very well recorded, if I can believe what I'm seeing here. So I just continue to talk. Thank you.